Good evening. Welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. My name is Dan Shustak, your host for this Spring Seminar Series. This annual lecture series is funded by MCLA's Academic Affairs, the Environmental Studies Department, and donors to the MCLA Foundation. Each spring, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability and the environment. This semester, our series topic is the science and management of invasive species. Over the course of the semester, we will welcome to MCLA various experts from state and federal agencies, academia, nonprofits, and private industry. Each week, our guest speaker will delve into their area of expertise related to the research and management of invasive species in our state, our region, as well as globally. Information and links to audio and video recordings of tonight's lecture will be posted at mcla.edu/greenliving. Next week, there is no lecture while MCLA is on spring break, and I invite you back when the series continues on March 23rd for Dr. Vitz's presentation on the invasive species of Massachusetts. Tonight's presentation will last around 45 minutes, and then we will have about 10 minutes for questions and answers. Tonight's speaker is Chris Politan. Chris Politan works as an ecological restoration practitioner through his companies, Politan Ecological Services and Land Stewardship Incorporated, which are dedicated to ecological restoration, conservation planning, and natural areas stewardship. Chris completed his undergraduate degree and spent the early part of his career in California's Monterey Bay region. Chris moved to New England in 2002 to pursue graduate training in conservation biology. He currently serves as Massachusetts Director for the Society of Ecological Restoration, New England Chapter, and chairs the Gill Conservation Commission. Please help me welcome Chris to MCLA.
Thanks, everybody. I'm happy to be here. As I was considering this talk, I probably went through a dozen or so presentations, and then at the very end of this exercise, I thought, what is everybody going to be? What do I have to offer? And I looked through the esteemed list of people who have been presenting on this topic, and I thought, I am really at my core a land manager. I really know a bit about controlling invasive plants, tools, techniques. So I'm going to speak to that and not give you a lot of other information, which I know about. I'm not a researcher, per se. I do have a science background, but my real, what I perceive as my contribution to the field is really as a practitioner. I'm working in the field, doing projects, planning projects, etc. And that brings a particular skill set, and you're sort of in between some worlds. Whereas I rely on scientists for a lot of information. In fact, I brought a few interesting pieces of information, and as I thought about more or less about my contribution, I did want to show you some of the materials that I rely on as a practitioner, because these may be journals and things that you're interested in, but invasive plant management actually has its own journal, and it's been around for about 5 or 6, maybe a dozen, maybe 10 years, let's say. But it's called Invasive Plant Science and Management, put out by the Weed Science Society of America. And then my professional organization, Society for Ecological Restoration, has a journal called Restoration Ecology. Not to be confused with Ecological Restoration, which is published out of the University of Wisconsin. And then there's the Natural Areas Journal. And these societies and organizations, they just provide a wealth of information for people in my shoes as practitioners to inform how we go about this work. So I wanted to put that out there and let you know how this field sort of interacts and where I need to go for my information. And, of course, going to conferences, sometimes formal, sometimes informal, is really important. But the more engaged you are as a professional, the better. But I probably go to about 6 or 7 events a year and just try to stay current in the field. So I'm going to dive right in with a Aldo Leopold quote, because this one has been so profound to me and perhaps to many of you already. But once you develop this perception of the natural world, and in particular invasive plants, you just start seeing them everywhere, and you can become more and more depressed as a result. And I hope that I can give you a little hope that we can engage with this process of managing invasive plants and not get overwhelmed, especially as you're driving. In my area, I drive a lot on Highway 91, where you just have these incredible shrouds of bittersweet in the trees, and it is really depressing. But you need to learn in this field to pick your battles. Invasive plants aren't necessarily the enemy. You know, we have created as humans a lot of this situation around invasive plants and how we react to it. Perhaps in some cases we don't react at all. We let them be. But to really pick our battles, and that's another whole message, and hopefully you'll pick up some of that in this distillation of any wisdom I might be able to offer. That's what I considered as I went through this presentation today. First off, just to guide us through this presentation, adaptive management, this cycle of adaptive management, where the first step is to figure out your goals and your targets, and this will automatically really help you significantly prioritize what to do on your property. The second is to identify and prioritize those threats. The Nature Conservancy, in particular, just over the last, say, 5 years, has really, their materials have strongly indicated that you shouldn't take on every project. You should really examine the project before undertaking it for the viability, the long-term investment, financing, interest, if the work will truly accomplish the goals that you're seeking to accomplish on your property. Because I think that in the early days of this attempt to do invasive species management, there certainly have been a lot of failures. And I've certainly been a part of projects that have failed, and most notably, the ones that start with a lot of enthusiasm, and then where are the volunteers? Where's the money to carry on? And that is disappointing when that happens. The third piece is to assess the control techniques, and that's where I'm going to really speak this evening. And then we'll talk about the other few cycles towards the end. You're probably familiar with these, but I just wanted to show you the most outrageous examples of these invasive plants in our region, many of which, all of which are here. And I happen to know that because one of the projects that I've been most intimately involved with is at Greylock Glen, which has been a huge undertaking of about 250 acres. And I wish I could declare it an absolute success. I won't declare it a failure, but there needs to be ongoing work. And I have to say that in the realm of, from the Department of Conservation Recreation, the town of Adams, and all of the players and people that are interested in that property, I haven't been a part of many dialogues recently about how to do the things that need to be done. I think it's part of it is because it is such a huge endeavor, but hopefully that will develop over time. But just to start, Japanese barberry, I'm not going to do identification. I'm not going to talk about ecology. I'm just going to try to impress on you how these plants can behave and illustrate some situations that I've been in where I've seen them and said, whoa, this plant can really take off when the conditions are right. And in this case, the conditions are right. They're moist. There may be, this is likely a landscape that has overabundant deer populations that are munching on the native plants, making room for the barberry as well. These may be calcium-rich soils like you have in this region and such, but barberry can absolutely explode. So can bittersweet. Bittersweet, in particular, can grow into trees and just overwhelm the trees with its growth and take over great portions of forest, as in this example. Wing euonymus or burning bush, in the fall, you can see these colors penetrating well into the forest, and oftentimes you'll find one lone plant by an old farmhouse or somebody's residence, And in all likelihood, that plant just reproduced and produced more and more seeds that have spread into minimally managed areas. Glossy buckthorn, wow. This one can grow in uplands and wetlands and can absolutely explode. The thing about it, I'm showing you these examples of plants that, you know, these explosive situations, whereas many of them just behave quietly for years before this next step takes place. What I'm seeing more and more on properties is that there will be little, I call them landmines of seedlings, you know, throughout a property, and not that these, I'm not to anthropomorphize these plants and say that they're looking for, you know, things to happen and to create explosions or to imply that they're thinking at all, but they are very strategic in that those seedlings are out there, and when that disturbance or that logging takes place, they're there to capitalize on that sunlight or whatever conditions. This feels like an abrupt transition, but again, I'm trying to distill some of the things that I've, you know, learned that I have to offer you as aspiring land managers or, you know, or practicing land managers to give you a perspective. But this mapping piece, as you're looking at the invasions in the landscape, I found that this is really important to capture via GPS photos, etc. Basically, you want to follow the distribution of the invasive plant. I often lump woody invasive plants together and don't differentiate except in cases of vines like bittersweet. There are herbaceous invasives which get a separate, all mapped separately. But often the woody invasives are all basically the same thing. Of course, they're different species, but they're treated the same way as far as land management activities go. Which plants there are, the distribution. I really want to know how many acres we have. I want to know the density. Generally, doesn't mean I have to do a lot of plant sampling. Most of my work is done with ocular estimates of density in a Dobbenmeyer system, which has these cutoffs between 0 and 5%. And you establish these categories that you can use. And then I've retranslated those into very simple densities like low, medium, and high with some negatives and pluses to indicate ranges. And then I want to know the height or the diameter of the plant, but usually the height, because that's going to determine whether I can, say, access that plant for a foliar application, or if I'm going to have to cut that plant or mow that plant in advance. The stage, seedling, sapling, and then I also want to know about the non-target vegetation in the area, if you have rare plants or if you have some leeway, because that'll help you decide the technique that you may use. And then, of course, sensitive resource areas such as wetlands. So here's glossy buckthorn in a small tree category. Greater than 7 feet. So for the most part, I'm going to look at this situation differently than I'm going to look at glossy buckthorn in lower state. So here I'm looking at something that's going to require some clearing, some cutting. And here it's much more manageable for various techniques. Versus here in a seedling phase, I'm going to be much more interested in hand pulling. And then furthermore, I'm going to look at the plant to determine whether these are seedlings that are from a seed or if they just look that way. If they've been repeatedly mowed or cut, they're going to resprout, and there's no way you're going to be able to pull those out of the ground just because they have a very strong root system. Seedlings pull out of the ground very easily. So that's the difference there. Then I'm going to map them. And in this case, I have something called, well, I have a subunit, which is tall glossy buckthorn in here as well. I have my wetlands or my streams here, and then I have low density glossy buckthorn throughout this orange span, but then I've mapped these inclusions so that I know in this, for this project, where we needed to cut or where we need, because we want to be reasonably targeted with our management techniques. So this helped to figure out different techniques in different areas. In this case, also, we had winged euonymus and we had garlic mustard. This is our current mapping system. And what this says, what this is trying to say is differentiate low, medium, and high density areas, red being high, green being low. And then each area has its own label. And then that is represented in a table, which lets you know the height and a little more information about the patch that you're dealing with. And then this is helpful for estimating how long it's going to take if you're using herbicide to know how much chemical you may need, and also for estimating how much money it will cost. Because basically, a lot of the work that I'm involved with is chemically, there are chemical treatments, and that's ranging between $250 to $400 an acre, generally speaking. And then depending on the technique, it could be upwards of $700, $800 an acre. So it's helpful. So you need to really distill this information that way so that you can help build budgets and start these conversations with you know, the people who want to continue with the project. This is going to be a little difficult to see, but basically we have these areas divided. You know which invasive plant is there, the density or the category, and also the size class, and then the area acreage. So then I can very easily put that in my spreadsheet and determine a lot about the management. And as I said before, it's useful to do this early on in the process, so that if somebody's imagining a $200 project, they're not completely shocked when it turns out to be significantly more than that. But it also helps prioritize, because you can see quickly that perhaps you're not going to be able to control all that glossy buckthorn, but let's get a group out there and hand pull the garlic mustard. And that's really valuable. And then wait for some funding to come along before you tackle the harder to deal with areas. Let's not read all this. The take home message, this is from a forester colleague. What I want to convey here is that some sites you may see, it's too late, and recognize that. And I wish I had recognized that in some cases of you know, projects I've been involved with, especially earlier in my career. But just to say, no, you can't do it. You know, it's going to cost a lot of money. And here's some examples. Oftentimes when I get called to a site, it's to accomplish the impossible. You know, like 10 acres of multiflora rose. Is it really impossible? Not really, but you're really pushing a budget, you know, in that circumstance. And my message is often, well, show me something easy to do, or let's analyze this landscape. And sure, you've got 10 acres of multiflora rose, but let's tweak our thinking a little bit, because we tend to go right here. We tend to also go right here. This one's kind of fun because you probably won't be able to make this out, but if you can notice a little haziness in this aerial, that's because it's an aerial with bittersweet completely covering the trees. And it's, you know, it's a large area. And that was another area that I said, I don't think we want to start here. So let's start pulling bittercress and garlic mustard, and let's do these areas that are significant to the view of passersby who love this landscape. Let's just not get involved in the impossible tasks right away. And that tends to be a good rule of thumb, how to prioritize. And also on the bittersweet front, just because you have bittersweet in the landscape doesn't mean the game's over. What is it about the bittersweet that bothers you, or bothers, you know, creates a situation that is not positive for the ecology of the area? Well, it's the bittersweet that's grown in the trees. So is bittersweet on the ground as bad as growing in the trees? No. So the way we accomplished this is we cut all the bittersweet out of the trees. We treated the stumps, the stems of the bittersweet, which killed it to some degree, but it's still plentiful. And all someone needs to do is come by and whack that down every couple of years to keep it from growing into the trees. So that took me about 10 years to figure out. So I hope that's useful. You know, don't just assume because it's an invasive, you have to do something. Early detection, rapid response, huge concept, you know, brilliant. wonderful message, and that is get it when it's early. You know, we're usually figuring these things out, you know, and it's too late. The awareness, you know, bittersweet is too late, all those and other invasives, it's too late, but it's not too late to have that awareness for other properties. So say a property that is in an early stage of development with bittersweet, take that on. But in New England, there a lot of people are talking, well, in the country, in the world, a lot of people are talking about, well, let's get ahead of these species. Let's figure out what the next invader is going to be and keep it off the landscape. And that does seem quite a bit more, no wonder you didn't know what I was talking about. What happens when you're using somebody else's slide? There we go. So in this case, your grand example right here in this region is hardy kiwi, of which I know very little. I know a little about, but not that much. So I'm going to use an example of Japanese stiltgrass, which I know a lot about because it's in the Pioneer Valley. And I've been trying to work with many other land trusts and partners and whatnot, such as Julie Richburg, who is here, and Cynthia Bettner, who is also here, to keep it out. And what's interesting about that is the more awareness you put on a plant like this, the more you find, the more people that are out there and getting trained, you find more and more, and then all of a sudden it's not really an early detection species anymore. And that's what we're learning in East Hampton, that the genie is out of the bottle. But what's really, it's not funny, but it is funny to me in a sort of way, is that I talk to people in Vermont about Japanese stiltgrass, about how they should really come on a trip with me to check it out and be aware of it, because it's probably there already and nobody knows it. And no one has taken me up on it, because it's just, you know, the awareness is, it's not in my backyard. I'm not going to, you know, worry about it until it's one of these situations. But that's what we're trying to prevent with this early detection concept, based on the existing species and on the new species. And there are a number of them, not to scare you, but there are a number of bad hombres, you know, coming onto our landscape. And Japanese stiltgrass is one of them, but Milaminid is another one, wavy basket grass. I find in my field, I've got to stay in touch with people in the Mid-Atlantic and Connecticut. I mean, Connecticut is just terrible with invasive species, and they're so far ahead of this. You know, they really take it quite seriously. Okay, back to our cycle. Now we're getting into the bones of this, which is the management and control aspect. And this will be a little bit all over the map, but I think you will come out with a really good sense of what's possible. Let's start with huckleberry. Not an invasive species, but a little science, a little plant science here, so forgive me. So woody plants tend to follow a cycle, and that is in the spring, as is coming, they will photosynthesize and try to produce sugars and strength for their roots to grow. And this typically happens in the May-June timeframe for woody plants. The message here is that's a real vulnerable time in a plant's cycle. So I use that to do something nasty to the plant. You cut that plant down, it's going to grow back. It's going to express its leaves, and then you're going to do something else to it. And so begins the cycle of depleting its total available carbohydrates, which are the storage reserves. So think about a really difficult plant to control, like Japanese knotweed. How many times would anybody venture a guess how many times you would have to cut or mow that plant to control it in how many years? Not that I know, but I have an estimate. Any ventures? I've done it 4 times a year for 3 years, and that hasn't worked. It's only made it more angry. No, in all seriousness, it has reduced the plant's vigor, but there's an Achilles heel for every, you know, invasive plant that you really need to explore. And in the case of knotweed, it tends to be somewhat inefficient to keep knocking it back and cutting it. Phragmites, the same thing. But garlic mustard is an annual, so it behaves a little differently. Stiltgrass is even an annual. So I guess the crux of the message here is know the plant biology and use that against the plant. The example I'm going to use for this exercise is black swallowwort. Is anybody familiar with that plant? I'm sure you have it here. We didn't have it at Greylock Glen. We don't have it at Mount Greylock, where I'm doing a lot of management work as well. Pale swallowwort is considered an early detection species. Black swallowwort is really pretty ubiquitous on the coast of Massachusetts as well as eastern Mass. So we want to go after this species. What do? We want to learn something about the biology of the plant. We have a lot of sources online. There are a lot of terrific websites. This one just so happens to be Vermont Invasives. And I had the opportunity to be a contributor to the site and volunteer some of my some information for management. But the take-home messages are, I'll read from over here, it produces seed pods in July and early August. It's a rhizotomous plant, 1,000 to 2,000 seeds per square meter per year. Sunlight promotes earlier and more prolific seed production, reproduces by seed, and seed dispersal by wind. Be scared. Be very scared. This is just an unbelievable, you know, unbelievably invasive plant. Very hard to get a grip on. But understanding the biology can make you see, make some decisions about it. Rhizotomous species typically are really hard to hand pull or to repeatedly cut. They're just going to come back. The wind dispersed seed really is quite scary because it's like dandelion in that it will just fly everywhere with the wind. The next step is knowing when to manage black swallowwort. And again, Vermont Invasives gives you a sense that May through October, but what it doesn't tell you is that swallowwort will it'll flower in June, usually by June 15th. So you want to prevent that. And it's taken many years to figure this out, but it has this incredible strategy where it will produce new plants all year based on seed. I don't know what controls this or how it works, but you also have to go back out in August because it will produce plants in August that can go to seed. However, the plants don't produce until the following year, so it needs a year to grow and then before it can produce the seed, which is strategic. So if you beat the cycle or you really knock it back the first year, you've gained some headway. But the problem is you have to be so incredibly thorough, and if you miss, you know, if one plant goes to seed, there will be that many more seeds that you have to deal with in other years. I had a project in Brattleboro, Vermont, over the last few years, and we were dealing with a patch the size of this room, which is nothing for swallowwort. And it was an incredible lesson to say that if you show up, you know, 5-6 times a year and treat a relatively small area, miracles can happen. I mean, we completely controlled this population around a rare plant. But, if any of you know this, it's that new bridge going on in Brattleboro off of 91. It's a beautiful bridge, but there are rare plants down there, bush clovers and a few others. In any case, we save this one room, and the bush clovers are loving life, but the swallowwort is just surrounded. I mean, it goes acres this way and acres that way, so it's fairly depressing, but you can do it. And then treatment methods. You have all of these options, from hand-pulling to mowing to full herbicide applications, and you gathered all this information on the internet from, you know, a respectable site. Also, sites in the Midwest tend to be excellent. We have a lot of the same invasives. New England sites tend to be pretty good. Like, I like this Vermont site. You will find a lot of information online. And for the most part, it's good. It's reputable. The government produces some good publications as well. But you really have to, there's not really a textbook yet. There's a lot that you need to decipher from practicing trial and error and talking to experts and online. But you have to get started somewhere. And the way I got started was the Nature Conservancy's Weed Methods Control Handbook, which is completely outdated and they don't have updated information, but it's a great start. And then you just start engaging with the plants. I'm a big fan of manual methods for small patches and when you're with groups. I love working with kids, volunteers, anybody. And what I found as a professional or a contractor was we were just going out and doing these, you know, these big projects that were important and wonderful, but they weren't involving the stakeholders. So this is sort of my restoration practitioner perspective, which is if you don't get into the community and get people involved and feeling like they're doing something worthwhile, it's not going to continue. The money's going to run out. The invasives are going to come back. And you really have to invest in people. You know, it's all about people. It really is. You may need a contractor to get ahead of it, but if the people aren't there for the follow-ups and just to care about the project, then that's not a good thing. So these tools are wonderful. I have lots of this stuff available that I just loan people or I take to projects. And I run, I don't know, 20 volunteer work days. I mean, I don't get paid for it. It's just you go out, you bring the tools, and you get the job done. And it's the best part of my job. In case you don't know about it and you're excited about this kind of thing, you should definitely get in touch with the Stewardship Network of New England, which is based out of University of New Hampshire in Durham. But I shouldn't speak too knowingly about this, but they are on the rise and they're trying to increase capacity to other New England states. Just a wonderful group that started in the Midwest and is very strong. They have clusters. They involve everybody to go out and do a lot of hand-pulling, weed-wrenching, and things like that. Love these projects. Can't say enough, especially around Earth Day. Now we're getting into mechanical techniques, which are also very important. What I've learned is that the mechanical and the chemical is the realm for success, for quick success, I should say. You do anything long enough, over and over mechanically, you'll get there. But being able to cut the vegetation, get it out of there, see what you're doing, has been just an amazing thing. Doing it with weed whackers, brush saws, mowers, walk behind mowers, tractors, etc. You get the idea. Larger mowers. This is a skid steer with something called a Davco mower, which isn't very common, but they are out there and available. But in this case, you're able to push back a field edge in this circumstance. No chemicals could be used here. So then this was lined with black plastic, and then a cover crop was put on after a year of baking in the sun, black plastic, just to give you an idea. Then even further, this is one of my favorite tools. I don't own any of these, by the way, but I know who owns them, and you can contract with them and have them come and do something. This was for Mass Audubon. This was 4 acres of autumn olive just below the Drumlin at Drumlin Farm. And I just gave them a proposal today that was about a year late, but just finished it today, so this is fresh on my mind. Anyway, after the cutting, there was an explosion of just sort of funny vegetation like pokeweed and Latuca cereola for you Latin people, prickly lettuce. There are certain plants that just love this disturbance, be it chemical or mowing or what have you. Just an explosion. And of course, the invasives exploded, and we were in there doing backpack treatments and hand-pulling garlic mustard. But in any case, they used volunteers to pick up all the sticks because there was a lot of woody debris left in there. And it's a beautiful meadow at this point, even though the brontosaurus mower crushed all their drainage, which was unfortunate, but we didn't know. Nobody knew. But anyway, this is a beautiful field contiguous with this, and it's, you know, for grassland nesting birds. So that's pretty cool. Here's one from my friend Seth Wilkinson on the coast. He does a lot of mechanical work with machinery, and we're starting to do more of that with walk-behind skid steers and things so that you can get in there and pull things up. And just consider for a moment, though, the disturbance to the soil. I'm not suggesting it's not the right way to go, but you're just always doing a cost-benefit. You're going to stir up a lot of invasives in the process of yanking things up. So be prepared to do more wholesale restoration in these situations. But I like that picture. And then what do you do with all the byproducts? Typically, you have some level of seed associated with woody shrubs, etc. I have been all over the map with this type of thing. It's not an easy one. My favorite is to burn it in place in the winter, cut, and just create a fire and just burn as you cut. And that's a nice technique. Create animal brush shelters. Chip. Use the chips on trails, etc. Yeah, it's interesting. Increasingly, though, we deal with Phragmites, which is on the coast, or we have it everywhere. But the Phragmites debris has been increasingly more complicated to get rid of. And now, on some projects, we're taking it to farms to compost, because the Phragmites is a really high source of nitrogen. And on, in particular on, islands like in Martha's Vineyard, there's a real shortage of nitrogen producing, you know, things that they can use in farm fields. So this has been a good solution because it's trapping the nitrogen and then you're able to make compost and produce crops. Goats. I have a little experience, but not enough to speak meaningfully about it. But I have a small herd of goats on my own, property, which is a lot of fun. Mostly they're cute, but they do eat pretty much everything. And increasingly, this is becoming a more viable option. And I would say it doesn't do everything. You've got to do it in a meaningful way. Intensively graze, let them off, and then graze some more. So as a solution unto itself, it has to be managed really well. It'll take a number of years. But they're a whole lot more charismatic and desirable usually than my crew showing up with backpack sprayers. So I like goats a lot. And if you can see this is mostly bittersweet. And this is a site where they just girdled everything. And they didn't get after the larger trees, which was nice, but they just girdled all the bittersweet and all the woody invasives and all the natives as well. So it's somewhat of a wholesale restoration afterwards, but why not? That's a great technique. A company I admire greatly is in the Midwest called Driftless Land Stewardship, and I think they have 140 goats, and they'll fence them in. Oh, that didn't. There you go. You take this permanent fencing on a solar charger, and you keep them in, and sometimes you'll have a guard animal like a llama to tell you stories about some experiences with llamas guarding goats and sheep. But it's a great kind of out-of-the-box technique, and I really think I like to do this when I can, you know, to hire another company to come in and do it. And I have an idea of doing this myself, but it's a lot of work. Because keeping in goats is a lot of work, as you probably know. They love to get out of there. Increasingly, and I really see this as the future, biocontrol, insects. We've been introducing them sporadically for spotted knapweed and not cypress spurge, but another type of spurge. Excuse me, I'm sorry that I'm not remembering the right spurge, but it isn't cypress, it's a different one. But increasingly I'm hearing at conferences that we're going to have biocontrols for Phragmites, for Japanese knotweed, and for many plants in the future, even swallowwort. And that opens up another whole can of worms itself, and perhaps a little scary, you know, but USDA, government organizations, universities are really looking at this as a viable option. And you probably know about the purple loosestrife success stories, which doesn't eradicate the loosestrife, but it has really made a difference. Propane torching, it actually works on Japanese barberry, and there is research to support it. It'll take a little longer, but this, and stiltgrass. So we've used it on stiltgrass, we've used it on honeysuckle, multiflora rose. When you do it on buckthorn, it makes it angry and grow stronger, for sure. But again, I know a fella in Vermont who has a tractor with two huge propane tanks, and he goes wholesale, and he works for the Dartmouth. It's in the town of Hanover, and it's for their water district, and they can't use any chemicals on these watershed lands. And they're just torching every invasive plant in sight. And it's taking a while, but it is working. And it's just another out-of-the-box idea. It's not prescribed burn. It's a very targeted treatment in that you're applying it to the crown of the plant in the case of barberry. So down below where it meets the soil and torturing that. I'd say it's about 60-70% effective. that's not bad if you have some time to work on it. And it's non-chemical, so that's a terrific option. Oh, I should say, though, make sure your conditions are moist, such as in the spring. It's nice if there's some snow on the ground. You can certainly cause a forest fire or a brush fire or something. So typically it's slightly inefficient, but you need to have water on hand. So for every person on a propane torch, you might have one person just shadowing them with a pack of water. Other notable methods. These are things that I'm experimenting with because, as I told the group earlier over pizza, I'm a really reluctant chemical crusader. I really am quite uncomfortable with that role that I'm in, and I don't want to be perceived as a nozzle head. So I'm constantly messing around and trying to figure out other techniques. So in this case, soil, solarization, or black plastic, it works, but it does have a deleterious effect on the soil because you're killing all the soil organisms, but you can restore those. So if, in this case, invasives, and then we're restoring the site with wildflowers, it's essentially a pollinator planting that we've created for this natural area. But what I may be doing in the future is introducing compost teas and things to reinvigorate what we've taken out by letting this sit for 2 years. Oh, this was a site with complete and total woody invasive, you know, horror story, which was all cleared about a decade ago, but the invasives kept coming back in those areas. And then this was a really nasty patch of bittersweet growing in trees. We deforested the area for early successional habitat and planted buckwheat as a cover crop. And the buckwheat is really nice because it spreads, it's vigorous, and there's still bittersweet in there, but they're smaller seedlings that we can foliar spray or hand pull or something like that. And this has become a really neat technique. And the buckwheat will fade out over time. It won't continuously reseed itself. So you can cut it and then plant your natives or allow natives to come back in there if that's your goal. These are new ones. Here's a couple of new techniques. Working with a group in Acton, Massachusetts, absolutely no way herbicides are going to be used on this property. Okay. I'm not terribly comfortable with guaranteeing that we can do acres and acres of this. What can we do? We're going to do some goat grazing. We're going to repeatedly cut knotweed. And in this case, we're going to use a stump grinder. As I said, with the propane torch, if you get that root collar, then you're in business as far as killing the plant. In this case, you're cutting the plant and then you're grinding it down. And we'll see how successful that is. But I think it'll work. A ton of soil disturbance and a ton of labor. But that's what it takes. This is kind of a neat one. I'm really excited about this. Buckthorn baggies. It's essentially a piece of a garbage bag, perfectly sized to go over a cut stem. This is out of the Midwest. You can use it on certainly glossy buckthorn, common buckthorn, but honeysuckle, other plants, and then you put a zip tie on it. So again, a really nice alternative to herbicides and a way that your neighbors and other community members and children, et cetera, can get involved with the project. Now we're going in the chemical direction and judicious herbicide use. This is about integrating management and being careful and limiting foliar applications and doing a lot of targeted handwork. So bear with me and I'll briefly describe these techniques to you. So as far as herbicide applications go, you have foliar applications, cut stem or stump treatments. You have basal bark and girdle, hack and squirt. And I'll show you what those are all about. So a backpack sprayer is simply a hand pump backpack sprayer or a motorized mist blower, or as things have developed, now it's a system called ThinVert, which is an ultra low volume way of applying foliar herbicide. It comes in a highly viscous, oily mixture called ThinVert, and the herbicide is put into that and mixed up in a very, you know, complicated manner. And then it's dropped off at headquarters from the company that mixes this. And then it's up to us to go in the field, pump some out into our backpacks, and through a specialized delivery system or nozzle, we're able to cut our herbicide use in, you know, very, very little. You know, I can't really quote, you know, we've cut our herbicide certainly in half, but it takes such a small amount of this viscous oil to come into contact with a smaller portion of the plant to kill that plant. That's a little scary, but it's very effective. And it's also more targeted than this technique with a motorized mist blower, which is simply, you know, you have a blower on your back and an herbicide delivery, and then this mist goes out. And in all truth, in skillful hands, it's a wonderful tool. It's about a 5% solution in a mist blower. In Thinvert, it's an 8% solution, so it's higher. Whereas in a backpack, it's more like a 2% solution. And it's all calibrated with how much liquid actually has to go on each plant to be successful at killing it. Here's an example with bittersweet alive foliar spray with a mist blower, bittersweet dead. In this case, it's a triclopyr-based herbicide, which doesn't affect the grasses, so it just targets the woodies. So you can mow this, and then the grasses will flush back. So really a pretty amazing technique, you know, through chemistry. Here we have our more targeted applications, which I favor, which is the cut stem. We do a ton of this. It's very laborious, and you're cutting, typically cutting with something like this manually, or a chainsaw, or a brush saw, or a pair of Felco pruners, and then using a sponge applicator, in this case, a buckthorn blaster. And I use these personally, and I recommend these to landowners that I work with. They're $6, which is very inexpensive. And your herbicide goes in here, and then your sponge goes on here. It's very secure, and then you can cover it up, and you can essentially just keep it in your pocket, or if you have carpenter pants or something, just put it in your pocket there. Have these with you, and you are completely invincible. There's not a plant that will not survive your touch. Large, you have to apply the herbicide around the cambium layer with smaller plants. But as you can see, look at all the natives you're saving. If I were to foliar apply there, everything would be torched, which wouldn't be, in my way of thinking. What I strive for is, let's turn this into ecological restoration. So this is ecological, closer to that than having to kill everything and then restart the clock and plant. I'd much rather keep what's indigenous to the site. Cut stem, lots of different techniques, from squirt bottles to the, you know, the paint store is your friend in this case. Lots of tools from the Nature Conservancy's PVC applicator, a lot of stuff online and things, but I've really settled on this buckthorn blaster as a very nice tool. This is what it looks like. You end up with a lot of material, cut material, but then there are all your stems right in here that are all treated. And if done right, none of those stems will come back. It doesn't mean the seed bank won't come back. It will. So you have to return, and then you can hand pull. In the case of bittersweet, just overwhelming trees, you just leave the bittersweet where it is, cut it at the base, treat the stems, let the natives come back around you. Basal bark application, I haven't always been as much of a fan. It can be a very targeted application, but as you can see here, you know, there's some stuff on the ground. I won't lie to you. But I have found that with rollers, you can go into a site in the winter. This is nice. Cut stem can be done any time of year, except when the snow is very deep, obviously. I've even done it when it has been deep on snowshoes, and it has still been effective, but you come back and your stems are about this tall, and you're thinking, wow, that's really funny. But there's a group in the Midwest, the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and their technique, they pretty much do all their invasives in the wintertime because everything's dormant. You just can't kill anything, and you're just doing this basal bark and the cut stem and just getting a ton of work done at a time that's traditionally completely unproductive. I already showed you this. Never mind. If you have trees, hack and squirt, very, very topical, very targeted, and in a lot of cases, we're just leaving the material to stand dead as long as it doesn't, not near a trail that will fall and drop on somebody later. You have to watch that. This was an area that was all Tree of Heaven, Ailanthus, converted into a community garden a couple of years later. Other selective techniques, one's called, originally called the bloody glove technique, now just the glove, because that wasn't too popular. And that's great for Phragmites and many others because you can just basically wick those plants and get incredible results. Cut and drip as well. I'm not a huge fan because it's so tedious and you basically lose your mind. But a friend of mine did come up with a technique where he would bundle them, tie them off, and then dab, and that shows a little more promise. But this is a great technique pioneered probably by the Nature Conservancy. I mean, they've been at it for a long, long time. Stem injection, Japanese knotweed, very targeted. That herbicide goes right in the stem. These targeted methods, the only criticism I have is they use a lot more herbicide. So you feel like you're being very environmentally friendly and benign, but the truth is you're putting 3 milliliters of herbicide into each and every stem. So you can treat, 1,500 stems an acre, a little less than that, with this technique. So what I've found is use it sparingly and where it really matters. Like I don't like doing herbicide applications near water, certainly foliar. So in this case, we'll stem inject knotweed right on rivers, and then we'll do a foliar application 20 feet off. That sort of thing seems to work. And of course, you can lose your mind doing that for days on end. Just an example of stem injection. This is the following year, and very little's coming back as far as knotweed. Well, really, nothing's coming back. I did that entire site myself in the early days. That was not fun. So the first year, you start your treatment, and you can generally, a good success parameter or criteria would be 90%. So a contractor, worth their salt, should offer you some kind of guarantee. So if I don't achieve that, then I'm coming back on my own nickel to achieve that 90% the first year. The second year should result in 95, the third year 99. And of course, I never represent that I can get you 100% of the way there. And it's not really false marketing. It's just that the point is that it's just ongoing. And so by this point, at the end of year 3, I want to make sure that there's a plan in place that you as the landowner are going to take over and are going to be out there. We can get off the herbicide bandwagon, thank goodness. And then we're just whacking them back. We're hand pulling. We're doing something. But if we give up at that point, it's all going to come back, as I've witnessed more than I care to admit. Okay, Japanese knotweed. This just gives you here's a failure. Success, failure. It's a thin line. So we had, picture this as all knotweed, but this is jewelweed, but this is what came back after the knotweed control. But there was a little bit of knotweed lingering down there amongst the jewelweed. So I was given false hope that the jewelweed was enough. And then over the years, the knotweed started coming back to the point that in 2015, it just was almost fully back. And that was sad but true. So if you get partial control or you get to that point, I swear I was at 99% control here. Not good enough. And what it says is, and this is really important, it's never over. I know that's thoroughly depressing, but you can never really walk away from a project, even something that's been thoroughly restored, because the invasives are always going to be lingering there. And if you do give up, then they will perhaps come back, but especially knotweed and Phragmites. Here's some success, though. Okay, so after that knotweed experience, I started working on my favorite sites in Falmouth on Cape Cod, and we had 2 acres of Phragmites. What happened? We mowed it, and then a wonderful storm came by and dispersed. I was just lucky. It dispersed all of this and took it out to sea. Wasn't anticipated. And then the natives just started to come in the following year. And then they just continued to come in to the point that this is 100% filled in with Spartina grass. And then I started to scratch my head and say, okay, this is great. This is really what we want. But I still have to come back to this site. It started in 2008. I come back every year, but it takes me about an hour to walk through that site and do my glove technique. I wish that I could do something different, that I could pull them, but Phragmites is tricky. So there's a success. Doctor's Creek and Chilmark on Martha's Vineyard, a really bad infestation. That's in the wrong place, but keep a mental note of just how bad that was. There's another slide to describe it. Upland plants, typically what happens is you can knock back the invasives, and then if you notice, this is the same vantage point, just photographed over every year. You had a lot of buckthorn, you reduced the buckthorn, you had buckthorn seedlings, and then you have a lot of bare ground, which isn't desirable, but that's seems to be the reality of upland invasive plant management, that you get a lot of bare ground. So you want to do something to restore the area after that. You want to use some kind of plant material or seeds or something. Whereas wetlands is a different story. Wetlands can take care of themselves. And I guess that's obvious because the moisture, you don't have that limitation as you do in uplands. So just talking about that, and I'm getting close to winding up. The active revegetation, it doesn't have to be expensive. You can buy nursery stock, but you can also collect seed. You can take cuttings, and I'll show you a few slides of this. This was a knotweed patch, a terrible knotweed patch. This was all invasives, and we're trying to convert it into a pollinator, wildflower meadow. And likewise, on a riverbank, that was woody invasives. You can take cuttings such as willow and red osier dogwood, which are free for the taking for the most part if you do it at the right time of year. Use those along stream banks. And then increasingly, I've become impressed with seeds just because it's low cost and really successful. Of course, you have to keep coming back and maintaining the sites, but especially in these agricultural landscapes, which can be problematic because they're early successional into perpetuity. You want to keep them in that state for your objectives. So to come up with something manageable, such as converting a cool season pasture that, you know, could become quite weedy with a warm season grassland or a pollinator meadow or something like that, seems like a good option. So increasingly I've invested more effort in seeding, and actually have one of these specialized seeders for drilling right into the ground so that you don't have to do a lot of site preparation, but you can get the seed right into the soil without having to till and do all those practices. Just to plug in the revegetation piece, that in ecological restoration, what you're thinking about, you want to have, it's not a whimsical thing. It is creative, but it's not, wouldn't it be nice to have a this in the spot? But it's really paying attention to the ecology of the place, what's growing, what should grow, being rather sophisticated, being, you know, about it and taking your natural history knowledge and deciding this is what belongs here. A really great tool for doing that is Natural Communities of Massachusetts, which is a state publication through the Natural Heritage and Endangered Species Program. Any natural community in Massachusetts will be conceptually presented so you can know which species are associated with these natural areas, and then you can develop your planting plan, go collect your seed, order the plants from the nurseries, etc. You'll always have issues over local provenance versus New England region, etc. Do the best you can. Don't get hung up on it. You know, it's better to have native plants. It's great if you can collect seed and do all that. I love to do it, but the truth is maybe 5% of the time I can. Most of the time I'm doing something different. But just to have that sense of place, because ultimately what invasive species do, you know, my idea, what bothers me about them is, as I travel through the New England landscape, I just start to see this homogenized grouping of plants, of invasive plants. And, you know, I like to be able to hit a place and say, I know where I am because there's this native plant. There's that sweet pepper bush, which doesn't grow in my region. But as I get closer to eastern part of the state or the coast, I start to see that, or holly or other plants. I think valuing that and then responding to it by putting the appropriate native plants is a really great way to put a cherry on top of your ecological restoration project. Monitoring, and I'm winding up here, always looking to learn and to justify what you're doing and to say, we're having an impact, or, oh no, this was a funny story because we got rid of the knotweed, and what do you think came in? The garlic mustard took over. So that was nice to have that record, you know, how rapidly that happened. And increasingly back to the maps, when I do a site map or when my team does a site map, we'll map the densities and all that information I showed you in a previous slide. We'll take that as a parameter for your monitoring and then do that at the end of the project so that you can demonstrate that if you had big, terrible monoculture of Phragmites, 75% plus, over time, it lightens up. And though you still have Phragmites, it's at far lower densities. And in this case, there are a lot of native shrubs in here, which makes work very difficult because you're trying to be targeted and do the handwork in impenetrable thickets. So it just goes to show that this is tough even a few years later. But you're making a change and you're decreasing it. And then the take-home lesson for me was, I can't do this in 3 years. You know, large patches of 7+ acres of something really is a much longer endeavor. You know, now this is on a 5-year time span to say, you know, we can really affect change. And I'm increasingly, the coastal work is where I'm going and where we spend a lot of time on these Phragmites patches. So it's useful to know. And they're very expensive and they're very laborious. So it's the least you can do is have some accountability and be able to point out to everybody what's going on landscape. And I believe that's it. That's my buddy Bruce. I wouldn't be here without him. I was talking earlier about this being a funny conglomeration of brains and brawn doing, you know, ecological restoration and invasive plant management. Not to say that Bruce doesn't have brains because he's a very smart person, but he certainly had the brawn and figured out all the techniques in the early days we worked out together. And he's just been a wonderful partner in this. And this is that Doctor's Creek site. 8 years later or so, I think it started in 2006. And to me, I won't cry in front of you, but I'll just say I'm very moved, you know, when I visit this site, because these plants are very special. They're indicators of a later successional stage in this natural community. And, you know, I'll pat myself a little bit on the back. If we hadn't done the Phragmites management, it would just be a monoculture frag. And at this point, through kind of this studying nature and trying to affect change in a compassionate way, this has happened. A small site, 2 acres or so. But what's interesting is when the very affluent area, of course, Martha's Vineyard, but when the neighbors saw this, they wanted to do the same thing. So now it continues. And then I expect that at some point, all of Chilmark Pond will be Phragmites free because of this sort of spreading thing. And people really like this effect. Phragmites is kind of unique because it provides it all, because landowners tend to like their views on the coast. So you give them their views and then you get the native ecology at the same time. So Phragmites just tends to be a win-win. In some cases, you have these windrows of invasive plants in suburban, you know, landscapes and stuff. Nobody wants to get rid of them because it keeps, you know, their properties private. So that's my closing, and that's it. Thank you.